I can't say I was right. I remember 3 o'clock in the morning in Chicago in a sleet storm. I want to show Chrissy before we check into a hotel where the school I really wanted to go to, Lane Technical School. I'm trying to find it, and there's sleet all over the windshield when a squad car stops me because I've got a Detroit license plate. They say they've got it. I made an illegal left turn. No one on the road, but I did make an illegal left turn because I discovered where the school was. And I get out, and this is really funny. I get out, and the officers say they've got to take me to the police department, the police station. And they want to know what kind of work I did. I says, well, I'm from Detroit. I work for the Ford Motor Car Company. One guy says, what kind of a car did you design? I says, well, the 1960 Ford and the 60 T-Bird. And they're arresting me in a 59 Ford Fairlane, the ugliest thing, in my opinion, with the mailing tubes on both sides, a high-looking thing. Half of it was emblazoned with chrome, and that's what they arrest me in. So all of a sudden, I see a 59 T-Bird go by, and they said, well, how do you like that car? That's beautiful. And what do you like about it? It's got straight lines. I said, what do you like about the 59 Ford? Because it's got straight lines. And I said, okay, you're driving a squad car. Now, what's wrong with the 60 T-Bird and the, or the 61 T-Bird? They said, it doesn't have straight lines. So one of the officers said, look, if he had anything to do with those cars, he's in enough trouble. Let him go. So I think, well, there's a lot of people who don't like anything I believe in. So I got me.
Did you feel a bit, as Shakespeare said, cribbed, cabined, and confined at Ford? Did you feel that your inventive creativeness was being held back and not really utilized to its best advantage?
No, I can truthfully say, as far as the creative stage, I didn't feel like that at all. I figured, when I first approached it, I was thinking in terms of, let's think about 4 or 5 years in advance. And what I found was that when the engineers would come in and look, they would say, we don't have enough time to do anything like that, and consequently, we can't even consider it. So I decided to change pace and extrapolate our thinking to 10 years ahead of time. Now, when they would come in, they'd at least listen, look at it, and try and discuss it on the basis that 10 years, oh, well, sure, inside of 10 years, we'll probably be able to make anything and everything. So everyone was more interested and more sympathetic towards coming into the advanced styling section. For instance, visiting dignitaries were never shown to the production studios. They were taken right up to the Blue Sky Room thinking place, the think tank. And when they got up there, the philosophy was, there's really nothing we can really use in the next 2 or 3 years, so it's harmless. As far as military secrets, they won't even understand what they're doing up there. Some people called us Disneyland, and Disneyland East, I think they used to call us. But that was all right. We were flattered by that. We were strictly the outer space people, and in those days, building a show car, remember, there was 100 show cars built from the time of the first Buick Y car and the Chrysler Thunderbolt, and then 98 cars, and somehow they stopped at 100. That's what's been recorded anyway. That included some of the 3/8 size models, I'm pretty sure it had to. But that was a real good barometer, especially at the auto show. It's Ford Gyron versus Firebird 3. And with our low price cars like the Chevy Corvair and the Ford Falcon, if somebody looking at both the Firebird and the Gyron, let's say he preferred the Gyron, he would invariably say, "Well, I'm going to buy a Falcon." Because the same blood roaring through the Gyron's veins will be going through the Falcon. And the same thing would happen with Firebird 3. I'm going to buy myself a Corvair, that's it. And I don't care where the engine is. If it's in the rear, it's in there for one hell of a good reason. So they were really, what they did to the public's mind, they sort of implanted the assumption that one of these companies has a better feel for advanced thinking and technology than the other company. And really, when these cars came out to and were shown at the auto shows, there was sort of a gentleman's agreement that whoever came up with a certain design theme, it really belongs to that company. And forget all degrees of design piracy. We're above that. Let's try and not copy anybody. But we will stake our claims that this is what we think a rear fender will look like, and we don't care what General Motors thinks that their rear fender should look like. So I didn't feel inhibited at all. In fact, there were times when I felt, well, this is the closest thing to right field that I'll ever see. Right field to me was, that was the ultimate place. As far as I'm concerned, my 4 years there are worth 30 years in the automobile industry. I felt so wealthy, not monetarily speaking, but I just couldn't believe this rapid state and open minds listening to people. It was great. I think I'll turn this supercharger on for a few minutes and we'll go to the next step. Getting back to the show cars, I think that really, the one car I'm really most proud of is the Ford Gyron. That Gyron to me was, let's say, my ultimate expression of the art. It was revolutionary. And by building a small model with a gyroscope, I was able to demonstrate that the vehicle could stand on its two wheels. I was able to demonstrate that this vehicle, by moving the model's front wheel, would bank through a corner like an airplane. And I made dramatic demonstrations of holding it high and dropping it on the floor where it bounced up and down and it wouldn't upset. And the model was made of aluminum so it could stand tremendous impact, and I would slam it into a wall and it would come back, and with its hose that was feeding air into the gyroscope, it still maintained its equilibrium. And then I built a platform that would go up and down this way, twist this way, and go like this, as if it's making a figure eight. And we had an electric motor with a belt that would have this platform. Then I'd put a four-wheel vehicle on it, and we'd turn it at full speed like this, and the vehicle would be thrown out, the four-wheel vehicle would be thrown out in outer space. But then we drop the gyro model on there, and I don't care what the condition of the road was. If it was like this, it went up in the air straight and came down the same way. No matter what, it always pointed itself as the road would twist like this, this was always vertical. So I brought Roger Huntington in, who was a very fantastic automotive writer, magnificent man. He's a paraplegic, types with a pencil like this, comes up with the with his fingertips, what he can do with the 6-inch slide rule. It must be that what he was using was really designed by Stradivarius and put with numbers on it. A man who I've had the most tremendous respect for, a man who for the past 20 years really has influenced all of us with his aerodynamic calculations, reduced to the lowest denominator so that people could understand it. He's made a few mistakes in forecasting things, but his batting record is 995. I mean, tremendous person. And someone who I thought was highly respected. And so I want him to confirm my calculations, and he wanted to write a story on it. And I says, now look, I can't say that everybody at the Ford Motor Car Company is impressed with this two-wheel philosophy. And please do me a favor, just for friendship alone. If you're not impressed with this, for God's sakes, forget it. Because I'm in enough trouble with the thing anyway. Well, George Walker gave us the conference room so I could demonstrate it on the big table. So I could roll that thing some 20, 30 feet dragging a hose and then go over there and hit it back and forth, turn it around and push it. And we also had the platform there. Roger Huntington said, Alex, you just created a new dimension. This is the ultimate configuration for any vehicle that'll move. He says, that goes for trains, it goes for, I see all sorts of possibilities, it goes for tractors, it'll be the end of the three-wheeled tractor, you can go between rows of corn without the nose wheel, it's a new way of farming on inclinations like this. He just wrote a beautiful article, and anyone reading it would be convinced with my last statement that perhaps four wheels are too many. That's where the statement started. If it wasn't for that vehicle, I never would have met the astronauts. The astronauts were so excited with the trail trucks that we built at Gyrodynamics. That was after I left the Ford Motor Car Company. And the streamlined train, the LBJ 200, which is now at the Smithsonian Museum. Perhaps we made a mistake. We were approached by a company by name of Chiyoda of Japan, who were so intrigued after seeing our trail trucks in operation that they wanted a high-speed train in Japan and invited us to go there to build it, design it, and build it. But, well, we were waving the American flag. We were going to make it right here in this country. As far as advanced technology in buses and all that, it's ironic that most of the world's buses, the real successful ones, are designed by Americans who could never get a contract to build it in the United States, so they all go to Germany where they have sophisticated double-deckers. I don't know what the next step is. Maybe triple-deckers or whatever. And it's unfortunate that, in a way, we've lost our real spirit of knocking off the competition, vaporizing them, slaughtering them, verbally speaking. I hate to see some of our advanced technology turned down and going to other countries. Because what made us all great, made the automobile industry great, we were the undisputed leaders in the world for so many years. And now we're sort of questioned. The magazines, just look at the, as some of the publicity, most of it is advertising. Don't have to mention the names. You know which ones are pro-American, which ones are, think in terms of an international scale. But gyro stabilization isn't dead yet, because before, Thomas O. Summers, who was the world's leading gyrodynamicist, and before we bounce off, he's 75 and I'm 70, so that doesn't give us very much time, but we're determined to build one. It might be our swan song, but then if you have to bounce off, you may as well do it with something like that. One last good, wild achievement, and that's that home run with the bases loaded. That's the one you never forget.
What design characteristics would this have in terms of today's concept?
Today's concept? I would apply it only to a two-passenger type automobile, because what I'm really shooting for, I want to see the lowest coefficient of drag number that it's humanly possible to reach. And it has to be a number that says this is the bottom line, that we're now down to, we can now get down to 0.10, one-tenth of what this sheet of paper could be, a little strip like this. All this drag has been reduced to just this strip of paper here. And it's just for a number. It gives us a scale. In other words, we might call the ultimate low number, start it with a zero. Say this is zero and this is 100. This is what people can understand. It's like setting a world speed record. My gyronaut, to me, was a design and mathematical exercise. Given 90 horsepower and a vehicle weighing perhaps 650 pounds empty, let's say 800 pounds with the driver in it, how fast can you go with 90 horsepower with a frontal area of 4 square feet? If you think you can go 250 miles an hour, then trace back to the one number that establishes the coefficient of drag. And what is it? Well, it happens to be 0.10, that's 10%. Or it could never go 250 miles an hour. Or I'm cheating a little bit, really. We only went 247.666. That, to me, was one of the tremendous highlights. It could only have been done with a two-wheel vehicle. Now, if I put two wheels and made it a tricycle, let's say two wheels in back, and even got the power back there with the motorcycle engines, then my CD would have gone up to about, now I got all this extra drag, probably 0.15, and I would have lost maybe 40, 50 miles an hour. One example of my gyronaut was, my driver really didn't believe in streamlining because he didn't understand it. So I thought I'd teach him a good lesson. So I said, I'm going to take the nose off the vehicle. That's half of the nose, about 6 foot long, beautiful streamline. That's what penetrates the air, and then it comes to a bulkhead. Because I want you to look at the front suspension. Now he could see it with the nose cone off. And I want you to observe its behaviors and tell us if we got enough springing in there. We only have 3/4 of an inch up, 3/4 of an inch down. So he says, how fast you want me to run? I said, how fast would you like to run? He said, let me shoot for 220, 225. I suppose streamlining is worth a little something. So he takes off. First gear was 150 mile an hour gear. He shoots it in a second, the thing decays. He has to climb up again. He gets in a third gear, That's all he gets hit was 150. Gets in the fourth gear, it slowed him down so much he dropped down. So, third gear. He comes back and he said, how fast did I go? I said, how fast do you think he went? Oh, God. Hearing all that wind, he said, I had to be 210, 220 miles an hour. And I said, here's your ticket, 150. And he was horrified. He said, you mean to tell me that that nose section is worth 100 miles an hour? And I says, yeah, that's right. It's 100 mile an hour, we put the nose on, let's call it a tailwind that's pushing you along. Then he appreciated the thing. And these were very dramatic demonstrations. Tells us what can really be done. You're getting down to the bottom end of the scale. The bottom end of the scale, as I see it, is 0.08 with this new two-passenger gyro car. People may not like it. To me, it's beautiful because it's functional. Because I always felt the yardstick for designing an aeroplane was, if it's beautiful, it's only because of the deep respect you had for reaching and simplifying the technology to the simplest denominator. It's function dictates form, form dictates function, either way you like it. Getting back as an afterthought to the New York designers, they are very successful as industrial designers. And I sort of have a suspicion that the beautiful cabinets and boxes and all of the new computers and all that are static pieces of architecture. They don't move. And it's a challenge to take a box and make a beautiful box out of it, put the numbers where they go. But they're successful because they're dealing with static. All right, there's nothing that personifies motion here. It's static. But it takes a lot of design talent to do what's happened here, to have all these things work, to cut the cost of the moldings, the separation points, the production, simplify all these techniques, put handles where they belong, numbers that you can read or things. This is true industrial design. They know how to design refrigerators, cabinets, buildings, things, providing they don't have much motion and you don't have to consider aerodynamics for a typewriter or any of these. That's a challenge for them, too.
Design may well be characterized as aesthetically pleasing with the feasibility, the mechanical feasibility, perhaps.
Yes, sure. With mechanical feasibility, I don't care whether it's a lathe or whatever it is, that has a great importance. In fact, I think infants that are born have a subconscious feel for beauty. I'm talking of a child that's 60 days old. Take a kitten while it's lying down and let it touch a kitten, and with the fur and the size of it, it's a thing of beauty. Now take a 10 or 12 inch alligator and shake it like this over its face and the thing starts screaming. It's terrified. I've done it and I know. it just frightens things. So we're born subconsciously with a feeling of beauty. Maybe the infant's eyes are always tuned to something of interest, whether it's a light source or whatever, or something like a rattle being shaken. And it receives it and programs it in its memory bank. And then, as the years go on, it further develops its sense. people like things or they don't like things, and they can't explain why they don't like it. I look at these art galleries, and some of the sponsors come in, women with a lot of vegetables and flowers and their hats. They look at this painting, they give it a critique, and cross swords with the poor talented guy. They like this one is better, or this is prettier. There are certain words in the vocabulary. This is a pretty car. I'd have more respect for someone who would say, this thing stinks, you know. At least he's put a little more horsepower that has some bearing to it. It's a fascinating profession to say that. You know, the stylist, the designer, he looks at things that nobody ever listens or looks at. I look at ceilings, I look at these sections, and a couple of them irritate me. I see a deviation of a 16th of an inch in one, and I write it off as sloppy workmanship, and then I say, oh hell, obviously this is the cheapest way to go. And corners, I line up verticals with the door vertical, and if there's a little mismatch, it means that the door isn't down straight or the structure isn't down. Because I've spent half of my lifetime just looking at a line, a roof line, and just take a little bit off here, put some on there. And really, the public can't really tell the difference. I see tremendous differences between the tin goose and the standard tuckers. It's little things that no one would look for. And to me, one side of the tin goose is embarrassing to me. I only allowed it to be photographed on one side, and we have no styling bridge, and how are you going to take a big thing that's, let's say, 80 inches wide, and one side's got to be different than the other, and I know the one side is about a quarter of an inch more, but that's nothing. I've seen GM cars that I had to put some roof stripes on for, what was that guy's name? The actor for Hickey? Jim Garner, yeah. Had to put racing stripes on the hood. So you know where the center of the thing is. There's a crease line there that says this is the center, the zero line. Okay. At the windshield, the same thing. And up the roof, okay. So when you get to the roof, it's a little difficult unless you take a tape and you go from the rain gutter over the roof to the other rain gutter. So we established after that reading where the center line was, and now we found out that the true center line was 3/4 of an inch away from the car. So when we put the stripes up there and you looked at it, so we figured, my God, this is terrible. This is a production automobile. So that happens with all cars. Our styling bridges are accurate to 1/10,000th plus or minus of an inch. And yep, the production car, the Kaiser Frazers, I remember when we were redesigning some of the cars, we take a new car and we'd throw clay over it, and the other side, you couldn't throw clay on it, was sticking out so much, so we would take this automobile and hit it and pound in one side for about a half inch so we could get the clay on it to match. I guess nothing's perfect, but with robotics coming along and some of the things, the way they're putting these panels on, and just sliding them in, really quite an achievement. Oh, we're living in a fantastic era right now. The next 10 years will show more progress than we did in the preceding 20, 25 years. And the years after that, wow, the sky's the limit. I
Who evolved, invented or evolved this dialing grid? That's always fascinated me.
It's
a worship tool.
Yeah. I would assume that for many years we had uprights. Like even looking at Mercedes, I think they just, a few years ago, purchased their first styling bridge. They were always able to take two big uprights like this, and another upright, and get a dimension, slide something up that said, this is 36 inches high, this is 36 inches high, so they put a plank of wood up there, and they put a level thing to make sure that the ground is level. But the first one I think who really did it was Gordon Burey, who designed a bridge with increments 10, 20, 30 inch line, just like we have here, 10, 20, 30, zero line, bang, that's where the wheel goes. And he was able to slide it back and forth. And as he had this big, let's say, glob of clay, they would push in a pointed plunger with a knurled knob to the dimension that they had. Push it in here, go on the other side, do the same thing, put a little chalk there, and when you got through, you had a big clay glob, we'll say, with punchers in it. And you take the tools and you scrape down to the surface. When you get down to the surface, you'll discover then and there if one of the templates is off. If you take a spline, a flexible thing, press it against there, and it's either come out too far. It has to be a smooth line. And from there, you translate the quarter scale to full scale. Then the surface development people come in after looking, translating everything from the model to full size. Now a lot of it's being done with a computer. That now you have the Michelangelo, which is a movable bridge that takes you up to the 10-inch line, and then the Michelangelo follows every surface, but it doesn't leave a mark. You don't even see it, but it's there. Takes a mark, and as it goes down like this, every inch and all that, it punches out a card that goes tick 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 tick, and the numbers flow until you get down to the maximum width, and then the undercut. They move it every 10 inches. Then they take the cards. Instead of tracing from an old wood mahogany model as they used to, they just take these cards to the Keller machine, which is a big, tremendous steel block. And as they set the grinding in motion, the Keller machine just grinds out the whole die. And that's it. That saves you about 10, 13 months of what it used to be. We used to have to go to the drawing board and make templates, and then go to Martin Red Gitgo. And his accent, he says, "Whoa, this is not smooth." So, all right, okay, Martin, do what you have to do. And Martin was such a leader that when he retired, I thought the whole body engineering profession was going to evaporate. What are they going to do? They don't have a leader like Rigetko. And he went on to live for a lot of years. No, people like that should be forced to work until they drop dead. I mean, they should have feelings of guilt, really retiring from an honorable profession, really. You ought to see what the body engineers in England used to look like. They were so proud that they used to wear a certain bowler hat, and they used to go to work with a cane, and they had the striped pants as if they were bankers. Everybody thought they were bankers. And the black Yeah, morning coat. And they were proud of their profession. This meant when you walked in, I am a body draftsman. You looked at the books. When I asked for books on surface development, I got to know about it. What do? They hand me a big, beautiful book like this. This is the Bible. I said, but these are coaches, 1868, 1870. I said, that's nothing. Everything you do to make that applies to an automobile. This is how you make a proportional curve. You have to, I said, but they were doing that 100 years ago. He said, it hasn't changed. So then finally, Eddie DeSmet came along, Willie's Overland, and he was the father of the DeSmet School of Body Engineering. Once you got your diploma, you could walk to any company and you take out this graduation ship, Eddie DeSmet. Oh, okay, we got to give you $200 more than anybody else. In the, yeah, that was it. They were sworn to secrecy, just like these magicians. They never disclose how they do these things, and they run a hoop through a person, and a guillotine doesn't really work on it, on a human being, because the head is still there when they got you out.
Where was Eddie DeSmet?
He was in Detroit and then went down to Toledo, and he became the chief body engineer for Willie's Overland. But meanwhile, he was still training people. And when you're looking for a body draftsman, you point the magic word. Do you know Eddie DeSmet? If they didn't know Eddie DeSmet, I wanted no part of them. I had to get an Eddie DeSmet guy. And all their secrets of surface development, little tricks and all that. They'd look around like this, you know, before they get there. And not let the other poor guy who's making $200 a month less even know what he's doing. And some of them would hide the fact that they were Eddie DeSmet graduates on the basis of someone, oh, Eddie DeSmet, I'll pick his brains. Oh no, these are military secrets. You hit them in your pocket like this. Areas of suspicion. So the profession's gone a long ways. Now the surface stuff down, hell, we design it, make it feel good. If it feels good, it is good. Then you take your templates. Me, when I design my automobile, say, what's the length of the car? I say, I don't know, and I don't care. It looks good. I design what I think looks good. After I get through, then I measure it, put the numbers down. And so I want to have a good piece to argue with. If I want 5 inches, I'll settle for 2, 2.5. So if I look at my numbers, oh, okay, I'll compromise with that. Tucker from the start was supposed to be 4 inches lower. I wanted that thing to be fully 8 inches lower than any car. 8, 9 inches.
You got it down to 8 and 9.
Yeah, we got that car at, that's 60 inches high. Yeah, that car was really low. You could tell when you was pulling up against other cars, they were always looking down on you. It gives you a nice feeling. Of course, this book that I got, did you glance through that book? I had it moved around. There's just a few of them there just to show you what we meant by some of the terms of stabilizers. This is really all crazy history. Oh, this is ultimate 300 mile an hour vehicle, gyro stabilized. Some things going on in motorcycles.
Can you describe some of those to the? What sort of design characteristics you were shooting for?
Well, these are mini cars here, yes. This is a small little, like the CRX Honda could actually, that was just born yesteryear, We could have had cars like this 5-6 years ago. Small mini cars compared to a mini car there, but these are honest two-passenger cars. Mm-hmm. You can see if you're designing a two-passenger car, how much more beautiful it would be than a silhouette of a four-passenger mini car.
Mm-hmm.
A series of sports car designs for a theoretical Subaru. Here's one that's sort of inspired by the Tucker.
I noticed that. Yeah.
That's right, with the center beam light there and the two lights that would retract.
Mm-hmm.
These doors open up from a hinge up like this. This would be the larger four-cylinder car. And what I'm showing here, you can see, I always like these NACA scoops. There's a NACA scoop there.
Mm-hmm.
It's dramatic. It looks like aircraft technology is involved. These are merely conventional-type cars made for the Subaru Brat with accessories. This is what I think a minivan should look like. Now, I've gone to some beautiful aerodynamics in the front and also the rear, but this dotted line here shows exactly what happens versus the VW Vanagon.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I've lowered it some 20 inches and still get people in there. This is a very highly streamlined two-passenger streamlined coupe.
Mm-hmm.
With curved glass from the wrapping all the way around to the rear. Beautiful air penetration because of the long nose. A beautiful taper to the rear of the rear end to
mm-hmm.
eliminate pressure drag.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're streamlining cars like this, the aerodynamic center pressure has a tendency to go forward. And that's why I carry the small wing back there.
The spoiler effect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But your minivan looks very much like the upcoming Aerostar from Ford.
That's right. That's right. Only this one here, I figured there's no need to make it more than 60 inches high. I still want you to feel that you're driving an automobile.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a front-wheel drive package, the floor is only 8 inches from the ground. You don't need step plates to get into it.
The effect of slipperiness here
mm-hmm.
is what you're after.
That's right.
And how do you attain that in this long, sleek, low design?
You take basic aerodynamic shapes, streamlined things. I don't care if they're rockets or what they are, or models of a fuselage. You get your drag data from it, and it looks like a simple shape, which means you've got to add a roof to it. And then you attack the roof on an aerodynamic analysis as if it's a separate entity, and it has to dovetail into this body of rotation. And we have all sorts of data on canopies from the aircraft industry that from a flat windshield, let's say, to a V-shaped windshield, to a beautiful curved windshield. And some slant angles have a lot to do. You look at the numbers and pick out the one that gives you the best visibility for the package you're trying to design, and see how it adapts itself to the styling end of it. Then you can compromise some of these things. What may look awfully good or better in some cases may not be quite as good. There may be better ways of doing it. So when you develop one streamlined automobile, you look for an area of suspicion, such as, what did I do wrong? You don't listen to people who tell you what you did wrong. You're the only one who has the real feel and understands the pick and shovel work that it took to get to that point. You become your most critical judge. And you close your eyes and feel the spot, feel, oh, this is what I did wrong. I don't see how Eric can do what it's doing. And that, this is when you're striving for perfection. Now, I'm an extremist in that way. Well, all these models I make to me have got to be absolutely the ultimate. Now these, of course, we're going back 40 years here, but I'm just showing you that things that were done 40 years ago could be very timely today. These are very sophisticated helicopters. We're talking of flying automobiles. The trouble with designing a flying automobile is that when you use the horsepower and you're carrying four people and you take the wings off, you are a better automobile than an airplane. So there's a point of diminishing returns. Make up your mind how you want to go.
There was some interest in that
a couple
of decades ago, weren't there?
Oh, yes, there was. After the war, we figured this would be the ultimate way to go. Like what I'm showing here. Here's an airplane taking off. But before it took off, look, starting from the top here, it took off, and then it landed because of bad weather conditions like this. The wings were taken off at the next airport. And what do you do here? You pick up a set of wings that are rented, and your transmission shaft, which is now connected to a propeller drive, and you slap that in, when it looks like that, and you just fly away. If you're going to run out of gas, say, well, I better be an automobile again because I see a gasoline station there. So you come down that way. There's a typical automobile. This is a streamlined shape to carry four people. And then, you can see here the nuts. Here's Evel Knievel. Wanted me to do a motorcycle for him to jump that Grand Canyon. And after that, here comes a young upstart, Craig Breedlove. Now, he wants to jump the Mississippi, so yes. I do this drawing for him. He takes a look at it, covers his eyes, and then sits here, and here it is. And here's a close-up of the damn thing going across the Mississippi.
There were some rocket car attempts for that. I believe yeah. Knievel and did come up with a rocket type.
Oh, yeah, he did. With and of course here's the Tucker's helicopter. This is one good way to drop the stretcher down like this and pick them up. You can tell this is 42 because look at what the ambulance looks like. Canards. This is the latest state of the art. Pusher props. Bang bang. The canard here, and the main plane there. This is all old stuff. 40 years. Interiors of gliders, as an example. Here's the latest state of the art. They're going to swept forward wings. And this one's at the Smithsonian. This is a helicopter. This is because of the helicopter experts say I made a brilliant breakthrough where we take the main rotor. In fact, it's a double twister to eliminate the tail rotor there. But what we do with this, we tilt. We don't tilt the whole vehicle. We want the streamlining, the low drag, to remain at zero angle of attack, but we want to do this to the rotor and keep it. Frontal area gets up terrific when the whole machine does that. Small little fighter plane type thing. Something very interesting, a single engine vehicle. Now here's a twin engine vehicle. Notice we have an engine back here on this airplane. We go to a transfer case here, and we operate two contra rotating props, flying saucers as I envisioned it, and got enormously, hit about 80 countries all over the world. Let's say that this could be the motorhome of the future. You got a six-passenger vehicle here. You disconnect the living quarters and take off with this.
Grumman,
it's articulated.
Grumman came up with that, stole that principle of the flexible bus, I believe, from you.
Oh, yes. Now, here's taking a car and pretending it has a Tucker innuendo. The very fact of the spinner there and the shapes indicate that this is sort of Tuckerized. Lady in Red. This could have been the first supersonic aeroplane because it had the power to do it. Except that the axiom stated nothing will go faster than the speed of sound. But it's generally accepted by all people that the similarity of the nose was similar to the Bell X-1, which only had 6,000 pounds of thrust. And here's a swept forward cargo glide.
Mm-hmm.
This
right.
is the ultimate way to go with these things.
Which is just coming into vogue.
Today.
Yes.
And this because in 1942, we had no way of really making a high-speed vehicle mm-hmm. that could stand the stresses. Here's a good indication of when you're trying to see what a quarter-size model looks like,
mm-hmm.
you draw it full-size and put plywood behind it. So it's done on black paper, and
mm-hmm.
it looks very realistic. Look at how this
mm-hmm.
simple, full-size airbrush rendering is compatible with an actual full-size car.
What did you call this model?
This was to be a gyronaut. All my two-wheel cars were gyronauts.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are again with the two-wheel car. These are the preliminaries. Now here is our trail truck. The trail truck was very interesting because the Department of Agriculture has to maintain 2,000 fire trails
mm-hmm.
in the country. To do this, they have 15,000 mules. And it takes four mules for one forest rangers to go from point A to point B in 48 hours. So you have to carry 900 pounds of equipment. Now, with the gyro transport system that we have there, we can do the same chore and carry the same amount of equipment and go from point A to point B and return in 6 hours. We built six of them, and they all went to the test facility, research, development, testing at Missoula, Montana. That's the proving grounds because of terrain. And unfortunately, we thought we could replace these 15,000 mules. That was the purpose of it. Unfortunately, the Sierra Club, which has a tremendous amount of influence and power, outlawed the use of all gasoline vehicle engines on the in the forests or on the trails. Even though we were able to come up with statistics that only 10% of all the fires in the world, forest fires, were really man-made accidents. That we had spark arrestors on this, and unfortunately that only infuriated them to the point where they took all the chainsaws away from their people, their forest rangers, and gave them the old two-man saw things. So there's a break-even point somewhere as to how much pollution can we tolerate, and is it really going to kill us, and how come we're all living longer if our atmosphere is so horrible. We're healthier than we've ever been. You look at the longevity of backward countries, and their longevity averages out at 22, 23 years. And here we are, when my father, when I was born, the longevity was 52 years, and now it is at 72, 74 maybe. We're getting healthier, whether we like it or not. Sometimes I think some of these government edicts sometimes convince me this is hypochondria USA. I mean, it's they have no right to discourage technological. They should show a little compassion for progress. I just think that agencies, I may not be very popular with them, but I'm distressed at the numbers that in the DOT, Department of Transportation, I understand that only 2% of the people are engineeringly oriented. And I think the only way we got into outer space, really, was that the task was so scientific and required a high degree of mathematical expertise that no one in a government agency could really understand what in the devil we were trying to do. And we just figured we better leave them alone because we don't know, you know. We could have had a nuclear airplane in 1965, 95% complete, when it was budgeted out of existence. These are tragic things. Some people wonder about the Spruce Goose, why it was retained for 25 years. And thank God we can all see it now. Frankly, it got its day of execution. It would have made a real good pile of wood if they ever lit it up. It would have been dramatic. But theoretically, it was the only airplane in existence that was large enough to carry a nuclear reactor. And that would have been something. There's no question about it, like it or not. As we get down to the bottom of the barrel, I see all these people today are starting to scream. We've had some critical electronic shortages just recently, and yet they're picketing the nuclear plants in that area, and I guess nuclear energy is responsible for at least 10% of it, giving them. The human body just has to learn to adapt, that's all. We'll evolve, we'll make it somehow. We're very lucky we live on this planet. We lived on the planet Venus, which is our sister planet. We have an atmosphere 80 to 90 times denser than we are. In fact, if you couldn't land on Venus, you could just jump out. And 5 or 6 square feet, you just spread eagle like this, and when you got down, bend your knees a little bit because you're going to land at maybe 6 or 7 miles an hour. And, but then the problem of going from point A to point B, I mean, you have to take extreme examples, like what if we lived in Venus? It's our size, so it must be like us. Baloney, it isn't like us at all. So this stretches your imagination a little bit. Especially when you discover your VW could only reach 17 miles an hour. You could never pull second gear, you have to do it in first gear. And Roger Bannister, 4-minute mile, well, that poor guy's going to take 20 minutes to do it. He's only going to run 3 miles an hour. I mean, he's pushing all this stuff ahead of him. You have to be inquisitive by nature. Question everything. And put it in your memory bank. Maybe you have to recall it someday. Maybe you don't have to. Maybe the things we talk about today, maybe my present memory bank, which isn't very accurate for the past few years, it's not that I've used them up, it's just I have no use for the data that I'm getting. But the past, I remember eloquently. Gee, it's crazy.
Is there room for a visionary today, like yourself, to move ahead in the present corporate and bureaucratic world?
I hope so. I really hope so. I've given talks to some of the large corporations, and I've had the vice president of the company come up and say, hey, the president of the company was very much impressed with what you had to say. And he thinks we ought to do something about making you a vice president. We don't know what in charge of, but he just thinks that you can supercharge a lot of us with some enthusiasm, and that we need something like this. But at least they talk that way anyway. They're supercharged. They say, wow, this guy's out of his mind. He's different, yeah, or whatever. But then the only thing that keeps me alive is my track record. I've done pretty well. I tell people. But the applications, as you can see, adapt itself to even military. Mass transit, as an example.
That would seem to be a perfect application of your forward.
Oh, yes.
Oh,
I should say so. In fact, Redondo Beach in California, if we hadn't gone out of existence, Redondo Beach was very much interested in our concept like this. As an example, here you see buses that are traveling on the road, but then comes the 4 o'clock to the 6 o'clock crash, bumper to bumper. And so now you climb up here on this ramp, and then people emanate from this large doorway here. They pick you up, and with gyro-stabilized ramp that we have here that we're on, we just eliminate all this confusion. You know, people are funny. You can't get them to be very sympathetic about mass transit systems. They prefer to go bumper to bumper rather than shoulder to shoulder. And I remember I used to ride in mass transit systems when I was a young kid, and I've seen people reading newspapers and touching somebody's elbow, and instead of saying, pardon me, the other guy would bang you like that, and pretty soon you've got a potential incident on your hands. Here we are now. We can show all the different applications as an example. Here, the greatest road system we really have is out in the ocean. Mm. You know, 20-25% of the people, the world's population, is based on coastal areas all over the world. And here's a high-speed 100-mile-per-hour cruiser on water running on two hydrofoils. And that would allow you to bank going right past our mountains or our islands. And here's the first gyro-stabilized successful automobile. And here's pictures of it in operation.
What was that called, and where was that?
We call it the Gyro X, and we built it in Northridge, California.
What year was that?
This was 1966 to 1967. It was the first successful gyro-stabilized automobile, inspired by the Ford Gyron, which was just an innocent, full-size model with a small-scale model demonstrating that gyro-stabilization could be possible. Now, what you see here is some people say, oh, I see you've got training wheels. No. You remember, when you're taking a two-wheel vehicle, you have horrendous problems. How do you get it up on a trailer to tow it? Because it's illegal to drive that machine on the road. Well, you have to have something with outriggers to simplify the task of getting it up there. But now, the gyro has to be absolutely free in its oscillation. If those side wheels, we had about 4 or 5 inches, which limited our banking capability because they were fixed for this operation. If that tire had just touched the gyro, it would have destroyed and upset the rate of corrective precession, and it would fall down. But we were able, now, we can bank at 45 degree angles with this vehicle. I think one of the most terrifying things that you would ever experience would only occur at about 8 or 9 miles an hour. And that would be our trail truck, where we had one that had front and rear wheel steering. This thing would weigh 1,600 pounds, and in this hotel room right here, sitting where we're at, we would take this vehicle that is about 5 feet high, turn the wheels, turn the engine on at 1G, and you'd see 1,600 pounds banking at a 45 degree angle, and maybe it's only 8 or 9 miles an hour, but that's what 1G is doing. It'd be a most awesome, frightening, terrifying thing you'd go through. And then as you shut the throttle off, as the speed decayed, it would return to its vertical. And then, since we did all this in this hotel room, they must have a big elevator. You see that door there? because we were only 30 inches wide. That's what we had to be. That door is wider. So you open the door, you back this vehicle out, and then search for the elevator. I mean, you talk of the exotic. It could mean in some areas a sidewalk would be adequate rather than a 12, 14-foot pavement.
What type of acceptance did you have on the gyroscopically stabilized vehicle?
I think the people that were most ecstatic about the concept was astronauts Tom Stafford and Gene Cernan. They looked at it, they couldn't believe what they saw. They saw that thing going down trails, crossing water up to the top of the wheel level, and they were ecstatic. They really wanted to see such a vehicle, and they invited us down to Cape Canaveral for the Apollo 7 shot. Since I had a week, I came up with some drawings. I never go unprepared. I don't go to talk to people unless I have something to talk about. So I evaluated the vehicle that they had, which was the four-wheel rover. They built four or five of them, a multi-million-dollar cost. And I came up with this concept. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Series of drawings like this, I'll show you later. Here's one just standing still, parked, just standing there. And
would the gyroscope work too well on the moon?
Oh, our problems would be greatly simplified. Number one, instead of a heavy gyroscope, all you have to do is compensate. You're operating in a mode of 1/6 the gravity of the Earth. Consequently, you get by with 1/6 the weight, or which is quite a factor when you're moving things in outer space. We have a rule of thumb: every pound up there costs $1,000. So the lighter the vehicle, the better. The very fact that we changed its code name to Operation Copernicus, because Tom Stafford was absolutely convinced this is the only vehicle in the world that could climb a slope like this at an angle, just like that, and take us up to Copernicus, the highest mountain, for a quick look-see. And number one, I could fold the thing. I could fold, here was the vehicle now. This killed a couple birds with one stone. What you see here is the subsistence capsule, highly concentrated, and our thrusters are mounted up high to give you the parasol, or the, as if you're coming down with the chute, instead of putting thrusters underneath, which requires maybe three gyros to do it. But the visibility of two astronauts coming up here and looking out here with overhead controls, observing their landing gear, just fascinated me. Then Tom Stafford looked at it and says, "My God, we just don't need this thing for this rover. You see, I'm showing this. It's pivoted here. I'm showing an astronaut there, and it folds up inside this nose cone." Their conclusion was that, as far as I was concerned, I was only worried about sustenance for 2 days. That they would, that was enough to get you back into the return ship. But they said this is without a doubt not only a tremendous achievement with the way I've stacked this gyro-stabilized vehicle, one and two wheels, but they said we need this as a rescue ship if we ever needed anything. That if we ever lost one of our astronauts on the lunar surface, it might take 30 days to get on this, to get another ship. And that if nothing else, we should immediately start thinking in terms of this vehicle. He says the only problem fabulous is that this is the most flattering remark that was ever made to me. He said, your trouble is that you're $4 billion away and you're 10 years ahead of us. And I thought, that's the nicest thing anybody ever said, coming from them especially.
Seems to sum up your career in a sense.
Yeah, it does. When an astronaut comes up to you and wants your autograph, I says, what for? This is young Alan Bean. He said, well, I'm one of the astronauts. And I says, no, I'm not going to give you my autograph. For what? And I said, you guys are going 17,500 miles. Oh, first he said, I'm an avid motorcyclist, and it's your gyronaut. Okay. And I says, no, I'm not going to give you. I says, you guys are going 17,500 miles an hour. I'm only going 250. And he said, yeah, but we're in outer space and you're in inner space. And that's a big, big difference. He's a magnificent guy. He wanted me to design sent him three different proposals on a two-tone gold Stingray cars. The General Motors suggested racing stripes. They didn't want that. They wanted a two-tone. So I came up with three different versions. And because he's a great artist, I told him, you make the final decision as to which one. And then from that drawing, you fellas can just lay it out with a good paint job and all that. When he retired, he made a very classic statement. I read in the papers that he retired as an astronaut, and I knew that he had art capabilities. And he said, I'm going to dedicate and spend the rest of my life painting moonscapes because I've been there. Oh, I thought that was a classic masterpiece. When I fight about my theories on aerodynamics, my wind tunnel is the Bonneville Salt Line because I've been there. And that wipes out anybody who's never been there and they don't know what it's like. So that sort of helps you drive home some points.
The mobile cart that they used, did you have any input into that?
Not at all. No, that was strictly a government project.
He didn't seem to have any real creativity involved, except maybe the lightness in the middle.
Yeah. And the wheel designs were sort of predicated on early thinking. I think they were wire mesh. You know, there were people that absolutely were convinced that on the lunar surface that it would be covered with 14 feet of dust and anything that landed on it would go through. So we had a bombardment of proposals, of big tired wheelies as the only way to survive going down in the quicksands of the lunar surface. And I always figured, it can't be that bad. There's no atmosphere there anyway, so how can it accumulate a lot of stuff like they think? I just gave it the benefit of the doubt, and one of the happiest days I had was when I heard that the first one that landed, they showed its footprint area of this, and that maybe the layer of dust is only about an inch or so. And so that obsoleted millions and millions of dollars of everybody that went and wasted. They should have just built two. One with the footprint of an elephant or whatever, and then one with just a landing gear like this. And then they lost the first ship because it was 13 feet of real dust. But to build all these others just didn't make any sense at all.
The Gyron seems to me to have still have commercial feasibility today.
Oh, I think so.
Are you still actively involved in that principle?
No, it's something we can't afford. Now, we were a small company, and in the late 60s, What occurred out here in all technology was severe cutbacks. And there were only 12 or 13 of us. And mass transit in this is impossible in this country. The Bay Area thing cost many, it went into billions when they talked in terms of millions. Mass transit people today show you big maps of metropolitan Detroit, Los Angeles, Chicago. And all it is a map they've been using for 25 years, and their solution seems to be make one-way streets and keep cars off the streets, certain streets, two-way streets. So in Chicago, they did that years ago. In 1898, a horse and a coach was much faster than an automobile that could average only 3 miles an hour with stop-and-go traffic in the middle of Chicago. But when they went to one-way streets, they increased the speed to 6 miles an hour. But a good horse and buggy at times reached 18 miles an hour in a congested area. I hailed a cab to go to the Plaza Hotel at the auto show in New York. I couldn't get a cab, so I figured, well, I know what I'll do. And, maybe I'll jump in one of these horse and buggy carriages. And then at the last minute, I didn't quite get there, so I hail a cab that picked me up right behind one of them that had just started. And do you know that horse and buggy beat us? We were hit by all the traffic lights. And he got there first. And it wasn't far, it's only maybe 3/4 of a mile or so. Picked up. But and then you look at the horse and buggy rate. There's been statistics that, of course, we didn't travel much. My grandfather probably traveled in his lifetime maybe 600 miles. And today we're all, they expect us, the average person will have covered, they say 600,000 miles. And the horse and buggy was 20 times as deadly per mile as an automobile. Horse and buggies could be dangerous. No, we've come a long way in transportation when you stop to think of it. When you think of our interstate system, here I'm not talking design, I'm jumping all over the place. Interstate system, what do we got? We've got something like 32,000 miles, and when we're through we'll have 37,000 miles. Would you believe that the Romans really built the first superhighways? And they built 55,000 miles. Can you imagine that? More than we have. They were all over the place. The funny thing is that I look at Ben-Hur's chariot, I suppose I'll dedicate it to him. 56-inch tread, the width of two horses. That dictated the gauge of rails on a train. 56 inches. All automobiles, 56 inches. And wagons, covered wagons, 56 inches. Tucker comes along, 63 in front, 65 in the back. Why? To keep from getting stuck in the tracks, the streetcar tracks. This was the big thing that we did. So the car became wider. And the lurch of only taxicab drivers knew how to cross the tracks. You do it at violent angles. If you get trapped in there, you're rearing can slide. Abraham Lincoln, in 1861 or two, addressed Congress and said, I have just had a 40-mile-an-hour ride in a train. I predict that we will someday have trains that are capable of a mile a minute. There were people that believed a mile a minute meant whoever went that fast was dead. And I propose that we increase the tread to at least 60 inches. Better yet, you could have said 70, 80, 90, or whatever. And then they turned them down on the basis that we already have 1,000 or 2,000 miles of track. And we'll have to change all our tracks. He says, no, we may have many, many thousands of miles more in the next decade. So let's come out with a new dimension and widen them. And that's what's happened. It's impossible to design, especially in this country. If you take a high-powered telescope and look at a railroad that you think looks straight, and you got 80 powers, so everything is reduced this way, 80 times, which amplifies all the deviations. And you look at a railroad track through a Questar telescope, and this is what you see. And no wonder you get all this side lurching. And when the streamliners came out, they were lightweight aluminum bodies, let's say, saved an awful lot of weight. But the trucks were still the old heavy things, and the unsprung weight ratio made them ride worse. The axiom used to be, oh, this thing rides like a Pullman. A Pullman was a big, and the high speed has to have a super track. Now, the gyro-stabilized track that we're talking about is the ultimate way. Have I come to the LBJ 200 yet? No.
Let me your people mover design seems to have been accepted in many areas.
Well, I don't know. Now, this right here, this is just a small model that I have, yeah. But the people mover could be adapted to.
Ford has a people mover.
I haven't seen it, but I've seen pictures and drawings, and I think that was done by John Nager or somebody.
One of your former colleagues.
Yeah. I start out with a block like this, make models like this, make an accurate drawing from the model, send it to Taiwan, and there's the first prototype.
Mm.
Bang, bang, bang.
Now, how would you describe that in terms of advanced design?
Well, this is a motorhome, really. The only thing that it really showed at that time, since they're all boxes, is that I paid a little bit more attention to generous radiuses around the corners and slanted windshields, even if it meant sacrificing storage base up there, and that we could develop the workmanship on this vehicle was really something else. This is not fiberglass. These bodies are metal, and they are hammered out by hand. That's why I had to put some side sculpture here. Can you see this side sculpture with this waistband going all around? That was a stiffener to keep things from oil canning. And everyone who would look at one of these, we built about 50 of them, sold them in this country. Everybody swore up, it's got to be fiberglass. There's no way anybody could tool up for something. This would cost millions of dollars. We were hammering out these bodies, as you see, just the bodies coming here, being shipped to this country. And now they're just waiting for the engines and the chassis to be fitted to it, to drop down it, and the wheels. These bodies were costing us just with the most gorgeous, beautiful teak wood interiors, not the thin stuff that you staple on, furniture. $3,200.
Mm.
Unbelievable.
And this aerodynamic design is really just coming into its own.
Oh yes, okay. Sure. Yes. Oh yeah, I'm talking to
the rounded corners.
Yeah. Oh, that is. And this thing's probably got a CD. This is good as some automobiles. Probably 0.45 at the worst. Mm. I'm just guesstimating.
Mm.
Then I have to flex my muscles once in a while and take a little engine. It's only 500 cc's, 27 horsepower, and then challenge the 55 mile an hour speed limit. And we rent the Ontario Speedway, and we travel 200 miles on 1.999 gallons of gas, and we hit 100 miles per gallon. On the straightaway, we're doing 115 to 120 miles on a gallon, which would be interstate. But when we got through the corners of the Ontario Speedway, we decayed to 85 miles an hour. And it was very impressive. It was a magic milestone, 100 miles per gallon. So it only carries one person. And but the lessons I learned from this, the next one's going to be so much easier. I can make a two-passenger now that'll do the same thing.
Subaru financed this.
Yes, they did.
X100 Gyronaut project for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did they, in fact, utilize any of the concepts that you developed in future cars?
No. They didn't understand it. They said, no, there's no way. Even Fuji Heavy Industries designed the engine. The best they can give you is 90 miles on a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had a 26-gallon tank made. So that my ambition was to go from San Diego, from the Pacific, to Savannah, Georgia, across the country. That's a short route. On less than 21 gallons of gas, average 100 miles per gallon across the country. And it would have been no problem. Number one, I picked that route. I don't have to climb to high altitude. Okay, which is around 8,000 feet. A lot of the fuel, especially coming back, it would have been nice to go downhill with the tank that sent me. But climbing up there, carrying that fuel, I got to pretend it's an airplane now. And we'd seal the tank and then have the 3A drain the tank to see what was left. And it would have been a very dramatic thing. It's strictly a one-passenger car. It's a working man's car. How did you get here? You came here alone. And everybody, these hours, they're all alone. They're going somewhere to do business or something. What the hell? It's 92% of us are all alone in an automobile. We've got 240 million Americans, and when you count the seats that we have in the cars on the road, they got 500 million seats for only 240 million to sit on. So there's a narrow band where we can say, let's make two-passenger cars, and let's even think in terms of a three-passenger car, maybe 5%, if we can get any new technological answers. But moving people, we can move people through the air with some of the new small little power plants. Hell, I'm looking at engines developed only 10 or 12 horsepower just to move one person. But very exotic steering gives us banking capabilities through the corners. In fact, we're starting to build them right now, and I'll find out. I'll let you know how I make out with them. In model form, it works. I got a lot of respect for models. If they're working a model, they're working a full-size car. And these are ultimate things. All my targets now are 250 miles on a gallon, and I'll still give you 95 to 100 miles an hour if I need it. But all I need now is 22, 25 horsepower. Not to hit that 100, but to gear it so high, so tall, with low RPMs, the engine thermal efficiency is operating at maximum when the engine is sort of lugging under full load. 250 miles on a gallon is not bad at all.
The one thing I've designed critical areas that you designed for is low horsepower without using, sacrificing acceleration so you can feel.
Yeah, I've still got violent acceleration. But 0 to 16, 12 and a half seconds on that.
The fuel economy and the acceleration is largely achieved by your design principles, right?
Yes.
And how would you characterize that?
Well, if you design an automobile to operate at the lowest RPM possible, you can do this through low aerodynamics because the horsepower requirements are lessened to force whatever shape through the air. And you have a transmission, and the transmissions are now coming into being. They're called the CVT transmissions, constants, velocity, torque, or whatever transmissions. You can now gear as tall as possible to lower your RPMs. Instead of a car that's cruising, let's say at 60 miles an hour at 3,000 RPM, you're cruising at RPMs down to about 1,200. Just a little bit over idling speed. Then your engine is realizing its full load, and the smaller the engine, the less internal friction. When you're evaluating the performance of an automobile, you take the aerodynamic drag and build it up 20, 40, 60, 100, 120, whatever. Aerodynamic drag in pounds equals aerodynamic horsepower. You take the weight of the vehicle times